Congratulations! You have found the Lambcast, the official podcast of the Large Association of Movie Blogs, also known as the Lamb. The Lamb is the largest collective of online movie blogs and podcasts with 2,000 members and counting. Every week on the Lambcast, various members of the Lamb community get together to talk about our favorite subject, movies. So bookmark the Lamb and follow us on social media. Be sure to join us each week to hear a lively discussion of films and movie-related talk from our members. Join the flock at largeassmovieblogs.com.
The internet is an irradiated wasteland. Within it lies a website. Outside the links provided, a desert, a cursed earth. Inside the site, a cursed web page, stretching from Great Britain to Los Angeles. A frequently broken digital highway. 2,000-plus blog sites living in the ruin of the old Lamb and the podcast of the new one. Podcasts. The Lambcast, Episode 719. Convulsing, squawking, broadcasting under its own members, Lambs in Fear of the Internet. The microphone. The podcast. Only one thing fighting for order in the chaos. The men and women of the Lambcast. Bloggers, podcasters, critics. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the dystopia that is episode 719. I'm your host, Judge Kirkham. Every month on the Lambcast, we have a movie put forward by a member and voted on in a poll to be movie of the month. For January, that movie is Dread, the 2012 action dystopia featuring Carl Urban as the masked executioner of justice. In addition to myself, we have three other jurists on the show today to dispense sentences on the perpetrators of this film. First up is Judge Kasner. 12 serious films reported every week, more than 1,000 per year. Can we respond to about one a week? Are you ready to pass sentence, Judge Kasner?
Inhabitants of the Lambcast, this is Judge Kasner.
Judge Simpson, abetting a bad movie is not just a fail offense, it's a crime. Are you ready to explain yourself?
I mean, I am the law, so yes.
Finally, Judge Baxendale Walsh, you initiated this trial. This podcast operates under the same rules as the rest of the internet. The Lambcast is not the law. Today, you are. Incorrect sentencing is an automatic fail.
Negotiating's over. Sentence is death.
Judge Heather won the poll, so she gets to run today's trial. All rise for Judge Heather Baxendale Walsh.
I'm standing here waiting and imagining that you're all standing for me. It's very exciting.
And here we are on our feet waiting for you to start.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for that wonderful introduction. I always appreciate them, Richard. It's so funny. I never really think in depth about my submissions for Movie of the Month. I just prattle off whatever's on my mind at the time. But I always try and pick something that isn't like super mainstream or something that everybody knows about or everybody loves, or I usually want to put something out that is either nostalgic or needs some extra love. And I won't shut up about Dread. So we're going on, you know what, 12 years now? Yeah, 12 years since its release, and I still can't stop talking about it. So I'd say that it definitely has some holding power in my heart. I literally just watched it a couple weeks ago, which is probably why I submitted it. And it's probably not the first time I've submitted this film. I, as some people know, I am a action movie junkie. I grew up in the 80s. So I grew up on Schwarzenegger. I grew up on Stallone, Bruce Willis, you name it. Those are my heroes of my childhood. I love those movies. I love a good revenge flick. And this is like in the culmination of all of those things. It is straight pure action. And we don't see those kinds of movies like we used to. They just don't really exist anymore. So when this came out, it was number one. I love the Stallone Dread too. It's fun. The Judge Dread. It's fun. It's not this though. It is not this. So I wanted to see it because Dread. And number two, Carl Urban. And number three, Lena Headey. I will watch anything with either of them in it. And then, you know, there was all the buildup ahead of time, too, about Urban not taking off the helmet. And it started to get all of this like, talk and excitement. And then I never made it to the theater to see it.
Oh.
Yes. I bring this up now, and I have to go on a bit for, so just bear with me. But it is one of my deepest, saddest cinematic misses ever. I've always been a big to the theater. I will make it there for great action popcorn flicks, and I don't miss them. And I can't recall what happened, but something happened, and it somehow slipped through the loophole, and I missed it on the big screen. So it's a big regret in my whole entire life. It's up there, guys. So when I finally saw this, I was lucky enough to at least see it on a big screen and with fantastic sound. So I definitely got the experience. And it is nothing but a slingshot from start to finish. There is not a deep plot here. I mean, the plot is pretty minimal. You could probably wrap this out in two sentences. We've got the big bad Dredd, as Richard kind of came in, the judges. They judge on the spot, though. There's barely any of this law enforcement in this dystopian post-apocalyptic future. And the baddest of them all, according to mythos, is Dredd. In this film, he goes into the story, gets a call, and that day he's taking on an apprentice being tested. She failed just below what she was supposed to for passing throughout the school, but they let her edge in because she's a mutant. She's a psychic, so they think that they can use her. But Dredd's the man, and he's like, no, we don't do that. So he already seems to have animosity towards his rookie that's coming with him for the day. She has to make all the calls, and, I mean, if you ever had an authoritarian parent raise you, this is like authoritarian parent to the max. You make one mistake and it's over. You're done. You fail. And there's no getting out of it. So they get a call to one of the mega blocks. I think there's six of them in the city. They get called to one of the mega blocks. It's called Peach Trees. There's been a murder and they have to investigate it. This turns into a complete crazy disaster. The megastructures are what? I don't know how many, like 200 stories into the sky. They're these crazy abominations. But, I mean, it's kind of what you look at. If the world starts to kind of fall apart and we all just keep building up instead of, well, anyway, let's not go off into the deep end there. Anyway, there's a big bad guy drug lord behind the whole thing with this drug called Slow-Mo. And that's really what's happening, is they eventually get in. And Lena Headey, who plays the character Mama, the antagonist of the story, and Lena plays this to the fullest extreme. She needs to take Dredd down, and Dredd and Anderson, his rookie, are going against hundreds and hundreds of big bads throughout the entire city. They start on bottom level, and they got to go to the top. And that's pretty much it. After that, you just watch the adventure of the two of them trying to get through it. It is so much fun. There's barely any dialogue. There's not any character development, not really anyway. It's just pure action. I love it. Visually, it's incredible to look at. Yes, the violence is gratuitous, but that's what you signed up for. Either you like it or you don't. And the sound is fantastic. This is all pure enjoyment for me. So that was my experience with the movie. What about you, Howard? I'm very, very curious how you feel about this one, Howard.
Well, I certainly liked it better than the original Dredd, which Judge Dredd, which didn't really work for me, and I didn't really care. The most interesting aspect of this movie is the peach tree itself, which becomes a character in itself, and it's an exaggerated view of something that really happened. In Chicago, it was Cabrini Green. I think in Boston, which is sort of where this takes place, I can't quite remember. I know it's a huge swath of combined land with their apartment complexes. And what happened in Chicago is that after World War II, the government built housing, low-cost housing, for veterans. But when black veterans tried to move in, there was so much racism that they couldn't. So eventually they had to start building other buildings for them, and eventually ended up with Cabrini Green. And it sounded wonderful at first. except that it was like 10 to 20 stories high. And they soon found out that wasn't a good idea because the gangs started taking over. The police didn't want to come out and do anything, and the police were on the take. So there was this big building that all this crime was going on in, and nobody was doing anything about it. So I found the building fascinating. It's like a character unto itself. It's very interesting in that you have two, I guess we call them now multi-use buildings, but the two bottom floors are a mall where you can pretty much get everything you want. You never theoretically have to leave the building unless you have to go to work. There's a skate park, on one level, so they don't have to leave to go to that. All the windows have like wire over them, so no one can break in. And this new drug is just going down floor by floor. So I found that very interesting. I agree, it's a very clean plot. It's not that original plot. There are many other movies in which someone has to get someone to safety by a certain time and everybody is after them to stop them. There's a Filipino movie, of course I can't remember the name of it, that's just incredible with the same basic idea. The acting's just okay. The background of the judges, I did want more information for, because right now they're just a fascistic police force. We don't know how they get permission to kill someone, for example. I can understand them arresting someone, but apparently they also have the right to just execute someone without a trial. And I wanted to know more about that. How does that happen? How does that work? And I certainly wouldn't want to live in a society like that, where these judges are judge, jury, and executioner all in one. So I would like to know more about the process of that. Overall, it's a very entertaining film. I enjoyed it a lot. Not a great film, but I had a good time.
Excellent. Excellent. You bring up a really good point about the building, too. I enjoy the fact that the movie is very, very straight and narrow. It's simple and it keeps focused. But I'm also very curious about the world, and I don't know much about the comics, so that's not something that I'm familiar with, so I don't know a lot of the background. I appreciate that they didn't delve into it, but my curiosity, I definitely want to know how and why the world got this way, what led to all of this. I definitely want to know more. I'm with you on that point. It's fine for this one, but as Richard might bring up later, I think that would be something more interesting to delve into in subsequent sequels if they ever came about, which they probably won't.
Actually, you probably don't want to know that much more because it won't make any sense. I mean, the world has been irradiated, yet there's this humongous area that covers more than one state that's walled in, I think. I'm going, that's not going to happen in an irradiated world, and you're not going to build these big buildings or anything like that. So I just sort of said, okay, I'll go with it. I know that's never going to make any sense. I'll just accept it.
No. We don't need any of the answers. We don't have to have them. It's kind of the point here, I think. But it still makes me curious. Probably because I've watched it so many times, too, at this point, where I've started to go. Like, you know, you've seen a show on repeat so many times. You're like, oh, well, I'm curious about this the C character that they haven't developed appropriately. Yeah, I've watched it 30 times. They probably developed it just fine, and I've just seen it too much. So I get you there. All right, Matthew, how do you feel about Dredd, and how many times have you seen it? Is this your first time seeing it?
No, this film was released on the 21st of September, 2012, and I first saw it on the 21st of September, 2012. And I've seen it several times since. In fact, I have logged it in my Letterboxd 5 times since 2016, which is when I started logging things in my Letterboxd. So, I find it to be an endlessly rewatchable, super fun action film. I've enjoyed listening to both of you speak about it, you've touched on stuff that I wanted to talk about, mainly in that, like, I really enjoy, I actually really enjoy the world in this, but for in the same way that Howard was mentioning that he wanted to learn sort of more about it, I kind of don't. I feel like it gives me everything that I need to know and nothing that I don't. Like, I find it to be very, very lean, in a way that I appreciate. And I do know a bit about the comics. I haven't read all of them or anything, but I have read some, and I've read up about them because I tend to do that about things that I like. But there's nothing like mentioning that, like, there's things you want to know about, like, the origin of the judges. And the origin of the judges is basically, like, there's 800 million people in a relatively small area, and they decided that it was easier to let them do what they want rather than to have due process. That's pretty much the whole background. But especially after the 95, was it 95, the Stallone one?
I think so.
I just appreciated that they, you know, they sort of overcorrected a little bit. Like, one thing that the comics do have is a slightly, like, it does feel a little bit more satirical, and this one, this movie's played a little bit more straight. Whereas the 95 one really goes, I would say, a little bit too far into the goofiness. That might be the least of that movie's problems, but it's a little too far into the goofiness. But on the other hand, I thought Carl Urban was perfectly cast. I really enjoy Olivia Thirlby. You mentioned that there's not very much character development, but whatever character development there is hers, and I think she handles it really, really well. And I just, again, I really enjoy the whole world. I also enjoy Peachtree's, the Mega Block. It does become a character to itself, like Howard was mentioning. And your dread trivia for the morning is that in the comics and in the movie, the blocks are always named for something. And in this case, Peachtree's was named because it's where the creator of the comic books and Alex Garland met to discuss the movie. It was a restaurant called the Peachtree.
Oh, that's cool. That's really, really cool.
Nice piece of trivia.
Yeah, definitely neat. One of the things that you said that I wholly agree with is the rewatchability of it. There are some movies that if you see them on TV, you just stop, and it doesn't matter where they're at. You're going to stop whatever you're doing and you're going to watch. And this is one of them. This is one of them. If I'm thinking I just need to watch a movie and I need to just escape from reality for a little bit and check out, this is one of the ones that is always at the top of my list to toss on. And like you said, it's just endlessly entertaining from start to finish. It grabs you and relentlessly holds on.
Yeah. And I would say, like, Howard's also not wrong. The movie he's thinking about that came out right before was 2011's The Raid.
Which is literally
the same movie, pretty much.
Great.
It's, you know, a cop goes into a building and the building locks down and everyone fights them. It's the same movie. But I appreciate them both because they tackle it, you know, slightly differently, or at least in a different language. You know,
there's a different language, and there's a lot of martial arts in the Indonesian one also. And there's not really martial arts per se in this one, but there's a lot more explosions and guns, and the violence is about at the same level, I think, in each. I think they're both great though too. I enjoy them both. So, all right, Richard.
Yes, I'm here. I'm ready to render my sentence. you know, and I'm not going to require anybody to go into an ISO cube, and certainly this is not a death sentence. This is a movie that I have enjoyed since exactly the same date that Matthew was talking about. I saw this on opening day in 2012, and I think I went back and saw it that same week a second time because I really enjoyed it so much, and I've seen it at least a dozen times in the last dozen years. I won't say it's an annual viewing, but it's one of those things that, like Heather was talking about, it's a go-to. I can easily pop it in and watch it because you don't have to think very much while you're watching it. You're not concerned with the plot. The plot is mostly irrelevant. It's all action. It's all what's happening at the current moment that I want to pay attention to, not how does this all fit together, what sneakiness is going on. Dystopian films I appreciate in general, but there are some that irritate me. The ones where The society has become so corrupt and sick that you can hardly stand to think about it. Always bother me, and I'm not a big fan of them. Sin City, for example, is a movie that I saw one time and said, yeah, I don't ever need to see that one again. On the other hand, on the other hand, this is a movie that's got a similar kind of bent to it, but it suggests that there is a world that is normal out there that is just suffering in comparison to all the dystopia that's going around. And the judges here are trying to hold the line on that, and it's a nearly impossible task. The Judge Dredd with Sylvester Stallone was a film that I did see. It was entertaining enough. It is a little goofy. Okay, it's a lot goofy. but I appreciated it because it's much more of a science fiction-y kind of story. This has a science fiction setting, but the story itself is really just about the action. And that's one of the things that makes it, I think, a little more straightforward to me and easy to kind of just tune in and out of at times. There are things about it that I think are very interesting. You guys raised questions earlier about the whole process and procedure. I do think that knowing too much would probably just become a path down a rabbit hole that we don't need. On the other hand, there were a couple of things that jumped out at me. For example, at one point, Judge Dredd says, you know, 99% confidence is not enough for a death sentence. And I'm going, okay. So there is some criteria that they use for making those decisions. And I guess it's up to the judge themselves, but there appear to be some kind of rules that they're operating under. And I think that we could use a little bit more of those kinds of things in the story. I don't want to go down, like I said, through a whole bureaucracy of what goes on at the Hall of Justice and how all the judges are selected and what the procedure is for making a decision to execute. Obviously, in most of the circumstances, the decision is instantaneous because you're dealing with people that are actively engaged in a crime, particularly a violent crime. And so it's an easy judgment to make. If somebody's shooting at you, you say, yep, I don't have to have much more testimony on this. I don't need to see any evidence. I don't need to hear anybody's plea. I know you're guilty. I see it right in front of me, and I'm just going to dispense justice now. That seems to be the fascist part of the presentation. It seems like it would be a little bit more effective, though, in cutting down on crime, but I guess there aren't enough judges to take care of the 800 million people in the megacities that we have here. Also, I got to be honest with you, I like being in peach trees. I think that that's an interesting concept, and of course, Howard mentioned it, and we've talked about it here. The Raid and the Raid 2 are basically, you know, the same kind of setup here where we have officers who are involved in against a criminal gang in a lockdown location and all hell goes crazy, which I appreciated. But there is a dystopia outside of the mega complexes as well. And that didn't look nearly as – I got to be honest with you. The dystopia in this movie looked like it was downtown Los Angeles this week. It's
well, I actually thought that too. What is the real difference between this dystopia and the real world today? And
yeah, I mean, you know, and actually traffic was better.
The line is thinner than I think we'd like it to be.
I mean, the advantage to this is that it becomes a commentary. If it's similar enough, it's a commentary on society today because it's basically saying there really isn't any difference between the world today. But at the same time, that you don't, it's not really dystopian then at this, you know. I like the fact that it was very, I say, like I said, this is Cabrini-Green. This is, if you go in The Wire, this is those big buildings in The Wire. It's just an exaggerated view of how society is today.
Well, I think too, I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that it does work too, is the presentation of it in the beginning. We can connect with that. It does look familiar to us. The mega structures obviously stand out, and then they give us the extra smoggy look and whatnot. But we jump right into something we're also all familiar with. We're chasing bad guys down who are drug dealers. I mean, we're this far in the future, dystopian world, and that's still a huge, huge problem. And they do right away acknowledge the fact that they are way overwhelmed by the population and trying to enforce law. So the harshness of the world, in a way, by showing us rather than telling us, kind of gives the explanation of why the judges exist and why the harshness of their judgment comes to fruition. It's also curious to me, though, that they are, the one thing that they do establish in the beginning is that, you know, we have to follow these rules. You can't get in even if you're a percentage off as a judge, blah, 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 with Anderson, and then making the exception for her. And yet, the idea in my head is this is based on perfection. You have to be the perfect judge, blah, 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 and above everything else. And then we end up with judges later
who are corrupt.
So, I mean, there are all of these things that we buy into with the world that it sells us. But at the same time, there are also these very familiar themes that we all can connect with and make sense to us because they do exist now. It's heavily exaggerated, obviously, in the movie, but they're definitely things that we all understand.
Yes. As I was saying, I think the film does a good job of kind of creating this world that we're operating in and explaining as much as we need to get. I do think that there is a little bit of the, you know, background on Judge Anderson concerning the mutation that she has that could probably be maybe set up in the background. At one point, the perp that they connect with, and I'm trying to remember if the character had a name, he's with them half the time. Is it Ray? I can't remember.
No, I think so.
But he says something like, you know, most of you mutants end up
with,
K. Most of you mutants end up with, you know, stubby arms and legs and, you know, in not very good shape as opposed to getting something like this. And we don't really see much of the impact that the mutations have had. There's a reference at one point to fatties, and it appears that we had a victim or two of those early on. There's, I think, the when they go into the Peachtree's complex, there's one laying on the ground there that is supposed to be, you know, one of those, and that sounds like it was also not just, you know, somebody overeating, but the one of the mutation kinds of things. But I don't know enough about the background to be able to say.
The fatties, I think, are actually, and I don't know this for sure, Matthew might know better. I think the fatties are a callback to the actual, to the comics. I think that has some kind of actual explanation in the comments, because I've heard people bring it up before, but I'm not familiar enough with it to speak on it. But I think that's kind of it, because there are all these people that, I mean, they don't have jobs for these people. They don't have anything for them to do. They're all just alive in there. And they're all continuing to have children, as we also see. So they're overpopulated. Clearly, the world has been subject to radiation. So it's also strange for me to see possibly overweight. So I think that's very, very interesting, too. But I think that has some kind of callback to the comics. I think there's something in regards specifically to the fatties.
There is. The fatties are people who have turned, because in Megacity 1, it's mentioned in the movie very briefly, but in Megacity 1, unemployment is like 95 or 96%. So fatties are people who have turned to gluttony as a means to pass the time, effectively. And I think actually there's one story where they're actually considered like athletes, like overeating is a sport.
Oh dear,
Joey Chestnut.
And there's this is one of the areas of the comics I haven't read enough of them to really speak authoritatively, but like it's definitely a thing in the original comics. Yes.
Well, it's an interesting thing though too. I think they explore that in The Expanse. I know that I can't recall if they do in the TV show or not, but they do in the book series, where, again, they've become so overpopulated on Earth that they have all of these people that they have no use for. They can't contribute to society. There aren't jobs for them. So they have this special place where they live. They receive monthly paychecks, and some of them are just people who just want to get by and do want to contribute, and then, you know, you have the criminal side of it, too. So it's an interesting thing to look at as you start to go down that rabbit hole. Also, Richard.
Yeah, well, like I said, there is just a lot about the background of the whole world that we're operating in here that would be, I think, you know, fertile ground for other stories. I don't know that they would be a good place to go with a Dread story, but the, you know, as a environment for making social commentary and satirizing the way the world is going, I think there's plenty here. In example, you know, satirizing the way the world is going, the mega complexes, like we've already talked about, it appears that they've got a mall on the first few levels where everybody can get everything that they need, and then the rest is for living quarters, and people don't even have to go out. And that's like the urban planning of the moment. You know, they want the world is out there to build up housing close to public transportation and close to where you have all of your, you know, what do they call it, like the 15-minute city, where you don't really have to go any place except for within 15 minutes walking distance of where you live, and you'll have everything that you need, so people will stop moving around, and it feels like this is, you know, the next step after that.
That's a really good, also scary point.
No, I love it. I think that would be great. I think this kind of building would be a great place to live.
Yeah, you fascist, you.
If it wasn't with, you know, the gang with the mobsters. They tried to do something similar in, what is the book and movie? It's not Skyscraper, is it?
Was that the one with The Rock?
No.
It's Tom Hiddleston. And
sorry.
Yeah, High Rise. You're thinking about High Rise.
High Rise. Yeah, they tried to do the same thing in High Rise, but they never made it convincing. This is very convincing. I could actually see this. Though there is a funny story, because we have a lot of, in LA, we have a lot of multi-use buildings, which is the first two floors are stores and everything. Then everything above it is apartments. And one person who just don't like these, I think they look great, said that he guesses the people who work in the stores live in the apartments above. And I said,
probably couldn't afford to.
Nobody who works in those stores could ever afford the apartments above them. But this is everything's in one place, which I would love, especially since I don't have a car.
Well, if there aren't, you know, drug overlords running the city and there isn't horrendous crime being committed, yeah, the idea of it isn't so bad at all. In fact, I mean, and like you guys have pointed out too, we're kind of moving closer towards that on the regular anyway, as our population increases and we don't have space to go anywhere but up.
I'm sorry. I live in Texas. We got plenty of space.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. You spent a good amount of time on that West Coast over there, all right?
Yes.
Yes, you still have wide open, beautiful spaces there. And that makes me happy for you, Richard. But we don't even over here anymore. And we're experiencing it in a different way, because I'm from Detroit. So people are no longer building up and in the city as much anymore. What has happened here is it's expanded outward. So all of the suburbs and cities and farm that used to exist outside of it now look, I'm probably from an airplane, not too much unlike Mega City One. It's all just covered in buildings and streets, and there's nothing green or growing anymore. So, I mean, it is. There's definitely a creepy aspect of that. And maybe that's another reason why we can all buy into the simplistic plot so easily. It's very familiar to us. It's exaggerated for the point of entertainment. And obviously, we get a considerable amount of gregarious violence. But yeah, it's not such a stretch. And it's very interesting. And it's terrifying, and also potentially, depending on what way we decide to evolve as a species, good.
Well, I hope we're not taking our cues from all of the dystopian films that are there. I hope that they're taking their cues from us, as opposed to the other way around. Yeah, let's go that direction.
Yeah, though. I mean, and that's like kind of the thing, though. I mean, I love post-apocalyptic dystopian films and stories too. I mean, they're warnings to us. They're little, hey, these are the things we're concerned about. I mean, how else do we come up with these ideas? we come up with the things that we fear, and then we write stories about them. So this is one of them realized. And yes, it's for entertainment purposes, certainly. But I mean, there's an ounce of truth there for certain.
Well, you know, they say that science fiction is really never about the future. It's always about the now.
I agree with that 100%. 100%. That's a brilliant point.
Well, that would make a lot of sense with this film because it really reflects the now in a lot of ways, like we've been talking about, both the urban development, the crime issues, the questions with the police forces, and, you know, the drug issue. By the way, when we change subjects, we do want to talk about slow-mo at some point. So
yes.
I don't want to get lost in our discussion.
I appreciate you being a grounding force, Richard. You know that I tend to go on tangents and lose my way. But you did mention urban development. So I would certainly like to discuss Carl Urban's casting here because...
urban development. I love it. You get bonus points on that one.
So rare that I'm actually clever on purpose. whenever I try, I crash and burn. But I've been a fan of Carl Urban for a long time. You know, I mean, he's just a guy who does really cool movies. And he has kind of, I mean, maybe not so much anymore, but he's been kind of under the radar for a long time. This was a big role for him. And he took it very, very seriously. From what I understand and what I've read is he was playing Dredd on the set.
Yes, I saw some of that.
Yeah, he kept the helmet on, which, I mean, that's one of the things that I appreciate. I mean, I think we've all kind of mentioned the 95 film, and we seem in agreement that it was fun. We don't hate it or love it, but it was fun, a little bit silly. Certainly a product of its time, but it was never anything that I felt compelled to watch and rewatch and thoroughly loved and enjoyed. In that timeline, if I was watching a Stallone movie, I was watching Demolition Man. But yeah, so we take on Carl Urban, who is not the biggest name. By the way, I heard that Michael Biehn auditioned for this role, which... A younger Michael Biehn, maybe, but not 2012 Michael Biehn. He's a bit long in the tooth at the point for that. But Urban sounded right to me, and he took it really seriously. So seriously that he wore the helmet on set. He had the character on set. Some of the extras said that he was quite scary and intimidating. There were people who would leave the room when he was in it because he would just grunt and not talk to people. And I've seen Carl Urban in multiple interviews on multiple things over the years. I've seen him in person. He is a really charming, nice guy. At least he seems like it. He's not that dude. So as much as I love seeing him when he's being charismatic and his personality comes out, I so thoroughly appreciated and respected the fact that he had so much respect for the role and the character, and it shows on screen. He spends most of the movie grunting.
Yes.
He spends most of the movie grunting, and it's great. It's great.
It reminds me a lot of some of those Clint Eastwood movies where he barely has 30 or 40 lines in the whole movie, and he's growling most of them. You know, Eastwood had a scowl. That's all we get from Carl Urban's Dredd is scowl because we can't see the rest of his face. And I like that, approach to it. You know, it's really about the character and the way that character is supposed to be this intimidating force and not really so much a personality and a human being as it is just the emblem of the tools of justice, the machinery of justice here.
There's a great quote from Urban actually when talking about making the movie around the time it was being made. Someone brought up that, you know, Judge Dredd never takes his helmet off, and he said I don't remember the exact quote, but he said something along the lines of like, you know, you wouldn't watch a Sergio Leone film and be like, oh man, they never even told me the guy's name. So it's sort of like the same the same sort of thing. Like, you don't need to see his, like, his helmet is his face. That's all you need to really know.
Just... Yes! Perfect. And I admit, too, I am a sucker for the stoic warrior types. So, I mean, aside from perhaps Henry Cavill embracing Geralt of Rivia, this is probably one of the best modern examples of the stoic warrior and fully 100% committing to it. He did great. I love it. It comes through on screen. And you know, you do. And I think, Matt, you brought this up, too, with Olivia playing Thirlby, playing Anderson, that she's really the only character development in the story, which we do see. But we also see Dredd acknowledge that, and he sees it. He's not a complete stone man. He certainly is a tough, badass warrior, but he sees, oh, I understand why we put her here, and he kept her in charge. And I think that's why we got the ending that we did, because he acknowledged that not everything is completely black and white, even though that's the world that he clearly has been living in and surviving in for who knows how long.
Yeah, and I think that actually goes back to something you said earlier about, you talked about how, like, you know, he often presents things in black and white to Anderson, even though, and, you know, he talks about how, like, she gets an automatic fail. A couple things she does would be her automatic fail of her assessment, but, like, I think it's interesting to watch it. When you watch it multiple times, especially, you really get the idea that, like, he's just presenting these situations to see how she's going to react. Like, that's not actually how it is. He's just presenting it in a clearer way or in a more black and white way to see if she, like, breaks out of that. Which I think is really what he's sort of looking for through the assessment, which I find really interesting.
I agree. Also, particularly, I think the most interesting part and where we really see that develop is after she does lose her weapon. So she already knows that she's failed. And seeing how she behaves after she's already made the conclusion in her own mind that failed is an attestment to Anderson. It doesn't change the way that she approaches the rest of the mission. And I think that's where Dredd was like, yeah, this is who we want out here as a judge. And he continues to let her make the decisions from that point on after she's technically failed as well.
Yeah, it's a nice piece of consistency. It's a nice piece of, like, consistency in the story that, like, he never, like, takes over as commander. He's always there just to assess her, even when things are going completely to pot, which I very much appreciate as well.
Yeah, he always gives her the option. What are our choices? Have you considered all the choices? What about this choice? What do you think we should do? You know, because it is training day. She's being evaluated in the whole process, and her ability to make a decision is the thing that would determine whether or not she'd be appropriate as a judge. I think that was very true to the persona of the character. By the way, I didn't mean to suggest that Carl Urban and the character of Dredd have no personality. They do have personality. He's got a wickedly dry sense of humor.
Yes. Yeah. It's very suitable for me. I love it.
I appreciated when we have that sequence later on when he uses the word wait and the other judge starts to mock him for it. And then we get the line, wait for her to shoot you.
Yeah. That's a great moment. Also, just like it would be unfair to say he doesn't have personality because, like, and like it's true he doesn't have a ton of dialogue, but I think it's a really great example of just economy of dialogue as well, because there's nothing that he says that isn't effectively, like, required for the plot, and I think it does a really good job with very little dialogue of sort of illuminating how he's reacting to Anderson as well, as evidenced by, you know, at the beginning when they're about to go in for the first time, he's like, are you ready? You don't look ready. And then at the end, he says, okay, are you ready? Oh, you look ready. I thought it was really, really well written in that way.
I thought so too. And you know, again, too, it's not lack of personality. I didn't think that you thought that either, Richard. But it is a stoic personality with an extremely, extremely dry sense of humor. It's certainly not for everybody, but it works perfectly here. I also think that Anderson, in a way, and I've watched it so many times since that I may be off the marker here, but I feel like in the first few viewings, that you kind of experience the movie or the entire everything that happens more through Anderson's perspective than Dredd's. So, and typically in movies like this, the point of view really is the, you know, the main character story. This movie is called Dredd. It's not called Anderson, but we perceive everything that's happening more from Anderson's perspective, I feel like, than Dredd's. We learn about Dredd more through Anderson's interpretation of Dredd rather than just him doing the stuff that he does, which is much, I don't have a problem with that when it works in action films. I'm totally fine with it. But I think it's a different kind of nuance, and I like that it wasn't typical, the same typical way we see that character, type of character developed in film.
I mean, it's sort of a weird, very, very dark analog of the sort of like Superman or Captain America character, right? Like, Judge Dredd is not a character that's ever going to change. He's going to walk into a situation, and the situation is going to change around him. And yeah, it's, I always find that to be just as interesting to watch as a character with a full-blown arc. But maybe that's just me. Maybe that's why I love Superman and Captain America, too.
Well, I always hear that criticism of Superman, especially, that it's difficult to make a movie about a character who is perfect. And you say, well, you know, the character who's perfect has to operate in an imperfect world, and that world either has to adjust to him or... we have to find a way for that perfection to exist in that world. And I think this is one of those examples where we just see the impact that this character has on the world that they are occupying. And I thought it worked really well. There are a bunch of other things to talk about on the film. I didn't want to get too dragged down in this. Heather, did you have some other things that you wanted to pick up on?
Thank you, Richard. I could go on forever. I have to acknowledge Lena Headey as Mama. I can't imagine another person in this role. A big part of the reason for me that the movie does work is the casting. You only have a couple real characters to sink your teeth into in this, and Mama is the one that stands out the most. From what I understand, she was supposed to be a much older woman, and Lena Headey was like, no, let's make her young and crazy. And younger and crazy and feral. And damn, she is. I am endlessly entertained by how terribly vicious and scary and also weirdly attractive yet unattractive Lena Headey is in this. There's just so many different weird elements of this character, and it should just be a typical, you know, big bad role, and it's so not. I mean, she just drank and soaked up this character and just was completely unleashed herself. It is, and she is so terrifying and so much fun to watch be just completely evil and cruel.
She does a nice job portraying somebody who's kind of reptilian and indifferent to the things that are going on. Let's face it, she basically, you know, there were 200 floors in this mega structure before. Well, there's one less as a result of her actions. And everybody on that floor, let me see, if we divided 72,000 by 200, I'm not good at math here, what does that end up being? You know, that's how many people she's likely to have killed in that one sequence, just trying to kill the judges. It's ridiculous. And of course, she tortures the guy who is running her ops in a delicate way. You know, he lives in constant fear, and she takes advantage of that. It's a well-written character, but it's also a very well-played character. And I also like the way it's visualized on the screen, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a really great segue into what you wanted to talk about earlier, Richard, which was the slow-mo.
Oh, yeah. Slow-mo is one of those things that, you know, there are all kinds of these drugs over the years that have gotten introduced into films. We did Minority Report as Movie of the Month, I think, 2 or 3 months ago, and there was a drug component in that was, you know, basically people taking something to kind of alter the way they operate in the world, you know, and this is the same kind of thing. I did like the idea that it's, you know, you basically feel like you're operating at 100th the speed of reality. And I'm going, I can't wait that long for anything. Why would anybody take that drug? Unless you were, you know, in the middle of doing something incredibly pleasurable and you wanted to extend it for a long time, I guess that that would make sense if you were having a sexual relationship or eating some food or watching a movie that you love and wanting to make every minute count 1,000 times or 100 times greater. Maybe that would be the time that you would want to have the slow-mo. But otherwise, it just seems like it would be an incredibly inconvenient way to operate. But, you know, I've never been big on any of those artificial mood adjusters, whether it's alcohol or pot or anything else. My brain is not the one that thinks about those kinds of things, except in the sense that how impractical is this? But I like the way it was visualized a lot. I thought that the sequence they basically cheat. They suggest what it's like at the beginning of the film when they drop the three skins down the center of the atrium, and they have loaded them with slow-mo, and we see just a little bit of it, and then they've basically set up that final section when, you know, not to do too much on the spoiler, when Mama takes the same trip. And we get that visualized as well. But we got a little bit of that visualization in the chase on the streets before they've even entered Peachtree.
Yes.
Well, and then there's that morbidly beautiful first shootout as well.
Yes. And that's exactly it. You said it perfectly, Matthew. I was trying to figure out
morbidly beautiful.
Because it is, though. It's this really strange dichotomy that you kind of get lost in, where it's horribly violent and awful, and at the same time almost magical, like unicorns could run through here at any moment. It's really, really bizarre, but I love how it makes me feel, and the fact that I can't entirely explain it is something that I think is fantastic. I love that feeling. But Richard, too, you were saying about not necessarily grasping the purpose or why these drugs would be so you know, engaging, or somebody would, I mean, you could say that, as you also pointed out, about any drugs to some degree. This one was very different, and that's one of the things I liked about it. I've read a lot about different kinds of stuff like this in science fiction in particular, where they tend to manipulate things a lot more, and this is probably one of the most interesting ones that I've seen. I love that it can be, like you said, it can be beautiful. And they show that wonderful scene with Mama in the bathtub.
Right.
And it is, it's kind of magical. Like, oh, I would like that bath, but I don't want to get thrown over the, over the 200 story building and take that long trip down. But it's also a fantastic measure of torture. Oh my gosh. It's not just physical. I mean, what it does psychologically, it's incredible. I can't entirely wrap my brain around it. And for that, I think it's absolutely brilliant. But it does. It works magnificently in this. I love that, Matthew. Perfect description.
Yeah, I think it also helps a little bit when we were talking about enjoying that morbidly beautiful shootout, that we are seeing CGI blood as opposed to practical effects, because I think it takes a little bit of the edge off of what we're looking at. We recognize, look, we're looking at somebody's cheek being exploded in slow motion and the viscera coming out on the screen. I don't think this was a 3D film, but if there was a 3D version of it, I'd be perfectly happy to put on the glasses and enjoy that, you know, spreading out over the audience.
Yeah, it is. It came out as a 3D option. And I'm not a big fan of 3D, but this is a movie I'd like to see in 3D as well. It would definitely benefit from that. Also, just the slow-mo with all the sparkles and, oh my gosh, you could reach your hands out and touch it. Ah, yes, I'm there for it. The visuals of this movie were spectacular. Absolutely spectacular.
I will say, as someone who did see it in 3D on the first night, that it does have the same problem that basically every 3D movie has, in that, like, the depth is really cool and the glasses move the color too much. So it did actually diminish the experience of those scenes the first time I saw it, because, like, a lot of the sparkles weren't as sparkly. Sort of ethereal nature of the color scheme in those sequences is horribly muted by the 3D glasses. So Until they fix that problem, that's my biggest problem with 3D, is the color muting. And until they fix that, that's the reason I avoid them.
It's always darker than it needs to be because of the 3D.
Yeah, it also just kind of makes it look like the film's color grade was, you know, that the base color was concrete to me. Like it.
Oh, no, that ruins it.
Like, it's not just that it makes it darker, it's that it makes it less vibrant. If you sort of catch my meaning in the difference there.
Yes, I absolutely
And I would say that, like, that was a one of the only things I didn't like about the film the first time I saw it. But that's, you know, the glasses' fault, not the film.
I didn't remember that I had seen it in 3D, but I went back just now to look at my original review, and I said, if you are clearly as bad a person as I am and take joy in the violent retribution that criminal behavior brings, then you'll want to see this in 3D. The viscera comes flying off the screen and splatters, metaphorically, on the audience in abundance. So apparently I did see it in 3D.
Well, that actually kind of soothes my soul a little bit, because, again, I am not a fan of 3D at all. In most cases, I don't like it. I enjoy it in James Cameron films, and that's about it. But Matt telling me that it was muted and looked like concrete and you not remembering it solidifies the fact that I've seen it just fine the way I have. So thank you for that. That was like a warm blanket of comfort. I have been sad about that for some time now.
Howard, are you still with us? I think we've been talking quite a bit and we haven't heard from you in a while.
Well, yeah, I guess because the certain areas that you've been talking about don't really match up with my feeling of the film. I don't think any of the acting is particularly good. I just don't think it's a movie where the acting has to be good. So none of them really... You say that Carl Urban has a personality as Dredd, and I say, no, he doesn't. He has no personality at all. Clint Eastwood had a personality. Carl Urban doesn't, for me. So the weakest part of it is the acting. I think that's sort of what stops it from really, you know, moving higher. And, you know, so there's that. I do think the drug is very interesting. It just reminds me of, you know, whenever you think you've gone as far as you can with drugs, someone comes out with something even more, both a bigger high and a more dreadful cause. So it's sort of a relationship to fentanyl.
Everybody's chasing the dragon.
Yeah, it's a fentanyl gives you incredible high, but it really destroys you in a very short period of time. I think you have a point in that. Well, why would you want to experience life in slow motion? But if you did combine it with something else, like another drug or with sex or something like that, it could be a really interesting drug, but I'm sure it's also so powerful that it'll probably destroy you fairly quickly.
Which is why they're so powerful in Peachtree's there running everything. It's clearly extremely addictive, aside from the fact that it can bring pleasure. I mean, if you use it for moments of pleasure, and then after that, it turns into addiction and desperation. And I think, like you said, Richard, just chasing the dragon.
I sort of disagree a little bit about the idea of slow-mo being an undesirable effect, because these people live in a megacity with 800 million people and 96% unemployment. I would say that, like, if the drug is pleasurable, then slowing it down and making it feel like it's lasting as long as possible, perhaps being your only moment of, like, pleasure or release or relaxation in a day might be a good thing.
Yes. Yes. Well, I mean, that's where its original appeal has to be. People would use it for that reason and that purpose, and that's where they get hooked.
Yeah, there has to be a euphoric effect of using it, but they never really explain that, because it really seems like it's all just about slowing down the way we perceive things. But if there isn't a euphoria to that act, it seems like it would just be, you know, right, uninteresting.
Yeah, and I would agree that maybe that's not very well communicated, but I would just assume that there is some euphoric aspect to it, because otherwise, like, why would you do it?
I think it is is communicated, though, because we experience it. We even experience the awful parts of it. But, I mean, we got the slow-mo death of Mama, and maybe we weren't experiencing it in a physical way, but as an observation, we got to watch her suffer the same death that she'd given to so many other people. And in its own beautiful way, she was falling, and we're watching all the beautiful crystals and colors. It was horribly wonderful. I mean, it was that again, that strange mix of pleasure and enjoyment and satisfaction, but also really awful. She's plunging to a very terrible, gross, and what will be quite disgusting death.
Can you imagine the torturous aspect if they give those three guys the slow-mo before they start skinning them?
Oh, no!
Oh, I thought they did. I thought that was the whole point.
Oh, probably.
And
yeah.
And there is a drug that exists.
Fortunately, we're spared that.
Yeah, you can't feel, you can't say anything or react anything, and you can't move, but you feel everything. So if someone wants to torture you while under it, you can't do anything, but you can feel everything.
Oh, it's sort of similar to slow-mo. That's a real drug. I don't know what it's called. I can't think of it right now, but you're right. That's a real drug.
Well, that's a depressing thought. Heather, do you have any positive thoughts to get us out of here? By the way, I noticed we haven't talked about Alex Garland, who is the writer, one of the writers of the film, but also apparently the co-director, although he's not given credit for it, and maybe even the main director of the film.
I've read that too, and I wasn't sure how true it was, so I didn't want to speak on it. If anybody else knows more, I would love to hear.
Well, I just heard
it's hard to say. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I just heard that the director that's credited, I'm trying to get his name, Pete Travis, was kind of excluded from the editing process, and that Garland kind of took over on that, and I don't know. Obviously, we don't have any insight into what happened more than 12 years ago now, because that was all in the production process. But I don't know much about what Travis has done in his career. I'd have to look him up and see what he's responsible for. He directed Vantage Point.
I did look him up, and I can't remember.
I think I did before too.
He did one interesting movie that I've seen called Endgame, which I highly recommend to people very much. It's since Alex Garland wrote it, and I believe he was the producer of the film. Pete Travis, in many ways, might just have been a director for hire type of thing, and then, you know, it was taken out of his hands. And Alex Garland oversaw the editing of it.
I'm curious what the entire story is there, though. I love Alex Garland films. Annihilation is still one of my favorite movies I've seen in the last couple decades. It's brilliant. And this has that, well, and you know, he does have that same sense in all of his movies of as a writer, but certainly we see it more as a director. Where he does have that mix of beauty and violence and gore and almost, I think we see it more in Annihilation, at least we see that intertwined with horror and science fiction too. It's very, very, very interesting creator as far as I'm concerned. I'm a fan.
Well, I was a big fan of Ex Machina. That was my favorite film of that year.
Oh, yes, amazing. Absolutely. Brilliant.
Not as big a fan of some of the subsequent films. In fact, Men, I kind of despised. It was annoying to me. But Annihilation was perfectly fine, and it has some sequences in it that I think are really effective. But this film, if he was given credit for this one, this would probably be right up there with me, you know, as one of my favorite of his films.
Absolutely agree, 100%. You can definitely, like I said, at the very least, you can see his fingerprints all over it. Not just in the way of storytelling, though, but in some of the visual aspects, they definitely line up with other work of his. It's very, very familiar feeling between all of them, and certainly thematically.
All right. Well, Heather, was there something else that you wanted to talk about as we are finishing up here?
I just love this movie. Yeah, I think we've covered a lot, actually. I think we did pretty good. One of the things I do love the fact that I think this will be my last thing to round it out, I promise, is the gun. The gun is kind of its own character, I feel like, as well. It's definitely, I looked it up afterwards, I'm like, this looks very familiar to me, but I know it's been modified, and it is. It's a Glock 17 that's been modified with all the cool adages and upgrades and whatnot. But the whole idea that once they realize that they're in the shit, that they have to start reserving ammo and do all those things. That's one of the things I really appreciate about John Wick. I mean, there's so much that's crazy about it, but he runs out of ammo all the time.
Yeah.
He has that realistic aspect of it grounds it when it gets so chaotic and crazy and ridiculous. But I like when films and stories make choices like that. And I did feel like we got to really experience the gun because of that. And because it had to be used so strategically, it did almost become its own character to me. But I thoroughly enjoyed the use of the gun. And I love the fact that if somebody else uses their gun, they get blown up. Consequences. That was awesome. Definite peak moment for me. So that's about all I have. Does anybody else have anything else they want to add?
No, I think we've covered it pretty well. I admire the movie for being the action film that it is. I do like the story setting. I kind of miss some of the science fiction-y elements that they had in Judge Dredd from Sylvester Stallone, but I know that movie was largely unsuccessful and certainly not popular among the fan base of that particular film. I'll throw in a little comment. When I was teaching my argumentation classes, there's a fallacy that exists when you take something that's supposed to be meant as metaphorical and treat it as if it's literal. And one of the examples I used to use was when the billboards were out for Judge Dredd with the Sylvester Stallone film, the billboard basically just said, Dredd, June 24th. And I said, if you take that literally, that's because this movie is going to open on June 24th, and it's dreadful.
Oh, that's hilarious.
But I, for example, I remember Max von Sydow taking the long walk at the end of the other film, and I remember the robot that was under control of Armand Assante, I like those science fiction-y elements in the story. They weren't necessary on this one. This one, like we said, is a lot more efficient. I'm not familiar enough with the comic books at all to know if the other things had any relevance to the original story one bit. And, you know, I didn't miss, what's his name?
You're probably thinking about Rob Schneider.
Thank you. Thank you. I was going to get there eventually.
Rob Schneider is usually terrible, though. I mean, I think that's like his whole MO.
It is interesting in the way that, like, Dredd is very much of its time for 2012 in terms of like the tone and style of filmmaking, and also Judge Dredd from 95 is also maybe the most 90s movie ever made. So it's an interesting point, at least.
It's very true, though. I feel the same way about the 95 one. It's not a favorite film of mine at all, but it is absolutely a product of its time. And Dredd 2012. There wasn't a lot of action movies, and there was definitely a shift that happened in this timeline and that decade in general. And I think it was a big reason that it did. It definitely had a lot of influence on the subsequent action films that we saw after it.
Well, it sounds like everybody's had their final thoughts in. For the most part, everybody's going to recommend it. We haven't been doing Lamb ratings, but we could do those if you want, Heather. It's up to you. You're the boss on this show.
I love being in charge. It's so much fun. And I love rating things. So let's do it.
Okay. Howard, have you got a Lamb score out of 5?
I'll do 3.
Matthew, how about you?
Oh, it's a 4 out of 5 for me. I actually totally get everything Howard is saying, and I don't necessarily disagree. But I find it so endlessly rewatchable and enjoyable that it turns into a 4 for me.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And I'm going to go with a 4 as well. This is, you know, if I was just rating it on its action-oriented basis and not thinking about any other film at all, I'd give it a 5 because I was very satisfied with it. But in the context of the rest of the world, I think maybe a 4 seems like a reasonable recommendation to go with. How about you, Heather?
I'm completely unreasonable. It's a 5 for me.
Excellent. Well, on that unreasonable note, we're going to take a quick break here to hear from a fellow Lamb Podcasting Network show, and then we'll be back with our exit question of the week.
In a world where podcasts already seem to address every imaginable subject, one man broke new ground with a seemingly random obsession about exploding helicopters in movies. He was a podcaster on the edge, a maverick broadcaster who played by his own rules. Now, he has a last chance to talk about the strange way helicopters explode in film. Exploding Helicopter, available on iTunes and Podomatic now. Think you know about chopper fireballs? Think again.
We're back, and it's time for the exit question of the week. I had unfortunately not advanced the question early enough to people to think about it for a whole week, but it was enough time for people to think about it today, and the exit question of the week is pretty straightforward. Look, Dredd is a movie that has a lot of fans. Heather is obviously one of them, and there have been a ton of people over the years who really wished that there could have been a sequel, but the film didn't do as well at the box office as it might have, and it doesn't look like there's much chance of a sequel showing up. My question for the week is, what other film would you most like to see a sequel to, and why? Something that never got a sequel that should have. Matthew, how about you? Let's start with you. What do you think you would like to have seen a sequel to that never got a chance?
It's funny you mentioned that, you know, you didn't advance this question to us early enough, but I didn't need any earlier because my answer to this question is always the same. There's another timeline out there somewhere in the multiverse where we have an entire shared cinematic universe of Master and Commander movies, and that's a better timeline than the one we're living in. I can't believe that film never got a sequel, and I feel like that's a near-perfect movie in my estimation, and I can't believe that it didn't connect, and I can't believe we didn't get, like... I can't believe we're not 12 movies deep in that series right now, especially given that there's like 25 books or something.
I was just going to say, there were a whole bunch of books in that series, right? I didn't read any of them, but I did know that it existed, so it seemed like there would be lots of opportunities to do that. And I thought the film was relatively successful in terms of finances, but I don't remember why there wasn't any follow-up. Maybe the production costs were just too excessive.
So yeah, it was one of those movies where like... it didn't lose money, but it wasn't like a hit, you know, like it wasn't a huge blockbuster. I think it effectively broke even because it cost so much to make. And then, you know, Russell Crowe was getting busier and busier, I assume, as well. But yeah, it didn't bomb at the box office. It just didn't make enough money, basically.
Since we're talking about it, why do you think it didn't succeed the way it might have?
You know, honestly, I'm not 100% sure. Probably because
I think it was too intellectual.
Yeah, too, I mean, it's artsy. Probably. I think a lot of people probably went to it, thinking they were going to get like a Pirates of the Caribbean type movie, and it's not that at all. And it's definitely not like a fun swashbuckling adventure in the way that pirate movies have historically been. It's a much more, I would say, compelling drama. But it is like a very talky and very thoughtful, and I don't think that's what the audiences were really looking for at the time. But
I had a friend who called it the thinking man's sea movie, sea adventure.
And yeah,
it is, but that's not a great compelling reason to get people into the seats. It can be the opposite, actually.
Yeah. So I think it sort of had its intent sort of going against it, for lack of a better way to say it. And but I think it's a nearly perfect movie personally. So I wish we had a dozen of them by now, because it's 20 years later.
Howard, what film do you think would have deserved a sequel that you would be willing to go and see?
Well, I have two, and I chose two because they're by the same writer. And it's Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and The Nice Guys.
Yeah, 100%.
Shane Black.
By the way, Nice and, Guys is my answer on this one, too.
Oh, love it. Neither of them did well enough financially to get a sequel. I'm real surprised that Kiss Kiss Bang Bang didn't do well enough. The Nice Guys, maybe because it didn't take place in present day and it might not have had the right marketing, that didn't do well either. Actually, in many ways, I'm not sure I want a sequel as I want a television series.
Oh, I watched that.
I love detective movies. I love whodunits. And on television, you can spread it out over 6, 7, 8 episodes. 10 starts to get stretching it. 8 actually starts to get stretching it. But and I always was hoping that they would at least do a television series out of one of these. But
they may have pushed themselves out of the television series because of the cast that they had. It would be hard for people in those positions to commit to a television role. Yeah, you'd have to recast. But I don't think I don't think you could recast those two films and have the same kind of success.
Well, I mean, they tried to do it with Lethal Weapon, and I know that the show is still on TV right now, but I'm not going to watch it. If they called it something else with everybody that's on it and even the plot, I would watch it. But it's not Lethal Weapon without Mel Gibson and Danny Glover. It's just not. Call it something else, please. And I'll sign up. I'll watch it. I promise.
Well, Heather, what would you sign up for if you had the chance?
Oh, I just pulled from the hip on this one. I've been watching lots of monster movies lately because I have a 7-year-old. And also, monster movies are fun. But he's obsessed with Godzilla. So much so that I was able to take him to -1. And he, after prepping him, saying, "You're going to have to read the whole time. This is a foreign film. Blah, blah, blah." Kid loved it. So he rocks. He's so much cooler than I am. But so we've been watching a lot of the old Godzilla movies, which I love. And then we've been watching some of the more modern ones and recent ones, which are just, you know, popcorn flicks. And they are what they are. I'm not a huge fan of them. They're entertaining. It's fine. But a monster movie that I loved, and I've been trying to get him into, is Pacific Rim. It was fantastic. That movie is spectacularly fun. It's enjoyable. It's beautiful to look at. There's humor in it. The characters are interesting and fun, and you care who lives or dies in them. And I just want more of that world. And they did actually do an animated series called Pacific Rim the Black, and it was on Netflix. I think it only did 2 seasons. It's not the same characters, but it's of the world, etc. But, I mean, I think they had an opportunity to...
Wasn't there a second Pacific Rim?
Yeah, I was going to say the problem with this is that there's a second Pacific Rim movie, and it's not very good.
Well, apparently, since I knew nothing about it.
Okay, but what's really frustrating is that, like, it has a lot of talent on board that you would think, like, on paper, you'd be like, yeah, this looks like it should be a good movie. And then when you watch it, you're like, oh, no, they didn't do that.
Gosh. Okay, so mine was a falsehood, but...
Pacific Rim Uprising is what it's
called. Yeah, I'm looking at it now. Charlie Day was still in it, too? Oh.
The only thing is it actually does have a couple of really good ideas in it, but it's a little more... It's not directed with the same level of care or attention to detail, would be the polite way to put it.
And I assume there's going to be a sequel to Godzilla -1.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm sure. I certainly hope so. That was one of the best movies I saw all year. Absolutely brilliant. Brilliant. Wonderful.
Well, if you check in on our end of the year top 10 lists episode, you will discover that several people felt the same way you did.
It crushed my heart and soul. I was in tears at the end. That doesn't happen to me. I'm not a crier. I don't cry. It was a monster movie, but it really wasn't. It really wasn't. Godzilla.
I mean, I am a bit of a crier, and it made me cry. So yeah, it's yep.
Yep.
Well, it's already been mentioned, but my choice would have been The Nice Guys. I love the combination of Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe. Russell Crowe is at his, you know, walrus best in this particular movie. He's just moving like a an unstoppable force throughout the movie. And Ryan Gosling is giving out the comments out of the side of his mouth all the time. And we talked about the girl on the show last week. His daughter was played by the girl who's in Mean Girls.
Anguria Rice.
Anguria Rice, right. And she was terrific in the movie. And she was in Mean Girls, the musical version of the film that we talked about, I think, last week on the show. And I thought they had a great combination of actors there. It would have worked really well to have a sequel. And I, you know, frankly, the setting, Los Angeles in the 1970s, that's everything that was going on. That's where I lived in the 1970s. I grew up in that time period. I was seeing those things and going, oh, I love this. I love this. It was my jam, and I just needed more toast to put it on. I really hate the fact that they didn't follow through. There was I'm trying to remember if it was a trailer or a preview or a single episode of an animated version of The Nice Guys that was also very entertaining. If you guys can find that, it's worth your time. It's not long, but it was a great concept for doing the movie as an animated series with the characters, and I enjoyed the heck out of that brief couple of minutes that they had on that. All right, well, that's been our show this week. We hope that everybody else is enjoying thinking about Judge Dredd, and you know, the show's always looking for new suggestions for Movie of the Month, so if anybody has a suggestion for Movie of the Month in the next few months, please be sure to submit it to the Lambcast so that we can include it in a future poll. I'd like to thank my guests and give them a chance to promote anything that they are interested in sharing with us. Matthew, have you got something that you want people to turn their eyes and ears to this week?
My usual, my usual output. I write freelance for a couple of places, and I have a podcast. The easiest way to find all of it now is to go to my personal portfolio page, which is stretched.ca. You'll find links to all my recent work there.
Stretched.cal?
CA, yeah.
All right. I will try and find that and make sure to post it in the notes. Howard, how about you? I know that you're always got something coming up, and I know I'm going to be part of that. What have you got to promote?
Well, I'm very behind, but I finally finished editing the podcast with Jennifer Van Ziel, where we talked Parasite and a ceremony in which finding good help can not only be difficult but deadly. I just recorded with the Verne. May, December, and A Dream of Passion. Those films are both about actors who seek out people similar to the role they're playing in order to get inspiration. Then after that, Todd Leibnow joins me for The Fantastic Mr. Fox and Straight Time, about two people out from prison who can't seem to let go of their criminal past. And then, yes, Richard, you and I do the Valentine's Day episode where we do Ghost and Truly, Madly, Deeply, where the ones you love, you never forget, whether you want to or not.
I'm looking forward to that. I got that on the horizon. Heather, do we get another volume of your book, or have you got something else to promote?
The third and final volume of the Prophecy series, No Fate, is with betas right now, so it will be out in early spring. You can find my first two books in the series, Lost and Bounty Hunters, on my website, heatherbaxendale.com. You can also find all of the podcasts that I host and frequent on there as well. If you want to keep up with what I'm doing, please subscribe to the newsletter. I biweekly send out all the podcasts I'm on and all the fun, weird stuff that I do, because why not share? Sharing is caring.
Oh, those Care Bears, they're still influencing us decades later.
Care Bear Stare!
And on my site, I just continue to post about the movies that I've seen in theaters. I went to a wonderful screening of The Princess Bride the other night with Cary Elwes afterwards, talking and sharing some stories about making the film. I'm going to see Galaxy Quest in just a couple of hours. So those of you who are fans of Galaxy Quest, there'll be a post up on that this week. And the usual, you know, whatever's new that I happen to catch. Apparently there are new films out this weekend, but I was busy living in the past, so I haven't had a chance to catch up on any of them. And on the Lamb site, which I've taken over, we're going to try and catch up on all of the backlog of people who have applied to be members of the Lamb, and I'm going to try and ask people to participate a little bit in keeping the site a little more vigorous, so it's not just the podcast that's coming up on the Lamb site each week, but we'll have some other people offering different elements on a regular basis. And if any of you have suggestions for things that you would like to see on a monthly basis or would be willing to contribute to maybe once a year for, please contact me. Let me know. I'm happy to work you into the schedule. And let's make this site continue to operate as a thriving community as opposed to a dying dystopian irradiated desert. Thank you all for joining us this week. And until next time, take care.
You've been listening to the Lambcast. If you have an idea for a show or would like to join us on the Lambcast, contact us at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Find us on Facebook, just search for Lambcast, or on Twitter, at Lambcast. The Lamb site can be found at largeassmovieblogs.com, and please head over to iTunes to leave us a review.
Go to hell.
Be careful, it could go off for like no reason.